From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Zainab Salbi says she felt compelled to help women who'd been raped during the breakup of Yugoslavia after she read a story about rape camps in Time magazine. Ms. Salbi was familiar with the way rape can be used to control and intimidate because she'd grown up in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, where she'd come to understand that women had no defense against sexual assault by men in power. The organization she founded, Women for Women International, has helped 70,000 women so far in 9 war-ravaged countries. She's profiled some of them in The Other Side of War, which is published by National Geographic, and I'm very pleased it has brought Zainab Salbi to my show today. Hello.
Hello to you. It's great to be here.
Your book contains a moving preface by Alice Walker. Wasn't she one of the first people you approached for support after you founded Women for Women?
Absolutely. Alice has always been there in terms of guidance and support, and I consider her an elder in my own mentorship and the organization's support.
Do you have any idea why that story in Time magazine had such a powerful effect? You'd read it at a party, and then you broke down weeping.
Because I, for many reasons. First, I also was going to school at the time, and it was my first time to learn about the Holocaust. I had lived all my life in Iraq until I was 20 years old, and I never learned about the Holocaust when I was in Iraq. And I was 23.
Because they don't teach European history, or because it involved mostly killing Jews?
Both. I think mostly because we have not learned about other people's history as well. It was very controlled by the Ba'athist party, and there's very much controlled by a socialist agenda, and that was it. So it was my first time to learn about the Holocaust. It was also my first time to learn that people didn't do anything about it when they knew about it, because they said they didn't know about it. And it was the same time I was reading the Time magazine, article, and so many articles. I was like, but this is happening now. There are concentration camps now, and there are rape camps now, and we know about it now, and we have to do something about it.
You also revealed in your memoir, Between Two Worlds, that you'd been raped by your husband.
My ex-husband.
Yes,
I learned over the years that my misfortunes have led to my fortune. The way I got out of Iraq, I grew up not in what I thought is a normal Iraqi family, but it's not that normal. My father was asked to be Saddam Hussein's pilot at the age of 11. And Saddam took over our life. He was like a poison gas leaked into our house, and we breathed him in slowly, and we resisted him slowly, and we sort of died slowly in our own ways. And the way my mother got me out of Iraq when I was 20, and I had a very strong mother who was adamant that I should not learn how to cook or clean, because no man should expect me to know how to do that just because I was a woman, that I should always be independent, that I should be strong, I should marry for love. And all of a sudden she tells me, please, please, please accept this marriage proposal in America. I was confused. You know, how could my strong, wonderful mother does that to me? I mean, why was she asking me? And she cried. She said, you've got to accept it. You've got to accept it. All what you need to do is just to leave the country. It was interesting because I did accept it to please my mother. And arranged marriage doesn't mean forced marriage. It means that you're asked, and, you know, my mother really wanted it. And it was ironic because all the things she told me never to tolerate someone talk to me in the wrong way or touch me in the wrong way, this man, who was Iraqi-American, did all the things, violated me in so many ways beyond the sexual ones. And I left him after 3 months. But beyond leaving him, when I left him, I had $400 in my pocket. But most importantly, I was so devastated that my mother did that to me. And I did not learn why did she do that to me until 10 years later. when she came to America, and when I learned, when I worked until 10 years after that, where I worked with women survivors of wars and dedicated my life to do that, that's when I learned why my mother did what she had did.
To protect you against Saddam Hussein.
Well, she was afraid. She was actually afraid that he was expressing a liking to me. He was making a lot of remarks about me, and she needed to get me out of Iraq and out of his sight. But it's also that's the time I learned that so many of the women that around me, so many of the aunts, my mom's friends, who have been through so much violence, and you just can't speak about it. And that's, you know, when a man gets injured in war, he's considered a hero. When a woman gets raped and through violence, a dictator, or through war, she is to be silent. We are all hiding the stories.
Well, in some cases, she's actually ostracized within her community.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's actually how I give really a lot of credit for the women who are breaking their silence. It is not easy to break their silence. And I always, when we mention the women in Bosnia who spoke about the rape camps, who spoke about how they were given numbers, and when their numbers were called, they had to go to the other room and gang raped for a period from 1 month to 9 months. The Rwandese women, where up to 500,000 women were raped in 100 days, spoke. We've got the Congolese women who are still going through rapes and violence right now are speaking out. And we've got to give credit for the women who are speaking out.
Because so many women who are raped really do not. First of all, they don't want to think about it. It's a traumatic experience. And then there's the embarrassment. And a lot of women blame themselves.
There is absolutely. Rape has historically been used in wartime, from the rape of 900,000 German women by Russian soldiers in World War II.
Which Stalin encouraged. It was a policy of the Soviet army at
absolutely.
That point.
Absolutely. There are pamphlets written by quoting Stalin to encourage them to rape Germanic women and break their Germanic pride, as he said it. But to the rape of 400,000 Bangladeshi women in 1972, it's always been used in war. What we're finding difference is that the women are speaking out, and for many reasons. In Bosnia, the women spoke out also because there was an institutional support to them. Religious groups in Bosnia went out and said, these women are heroines of war, basically. They're just as any soldier who loses his leg or his hand or whatever in war. In Rwanda, they spoke out because also there was a support for them. So that speaking out is very important, and it's a historical change.
Now, did you go to Bosnia when you found out about that? I know 20,000 women were raped in the camps alone, and then many more were raped outside of the camps. Did you go there, or was it way after the fact?
No, I went to Croatia. I couldn't enter to Bosnia. So I was 23. I had by that time married my current husband, I chose him. He's a wonderful man.
And he was encouraging you to get
and
involved?
And he was the co-founder, absolutely, of the organization. And we went to Croatia to start the program. And the first meeting, I remember, it was 9 o'clock in the morning, first day we arrived, and it changed my life. It was with a meeting with a woman called Aisha, who had imprisoned in a rape camp for 9 months. She had a baby as a result, who she lost as a result of health complications. She could not find her husband and her two children, and she was just absolutely crying. And she was talking about a group that brought her to the U.S. to give testimony to the Hill and then returned her back to Croatia without providing her with any health services or anything like that. And she was absolutely devastated. And that was the moment in which I said, I will not be able to go back to my life. I will have to dedicate my life to women like her. And I, more than others, understood not only the meaning of rape, but the meaning of what does it mean to live in war.
One of the stories you tell in the book concerns a Bosnian woman who had been abducted from her home while her husband was out by a group of men who raped her repeatedly. And then they discussed whether they should kill her or not after they'd finished with her. And one of them said they didn't need to because she'd kill herself.
Right.
Well, are suicides common among these women who've been raped?
Not always. Sometimes it is. It's the absolute silence. One of the quotes that touched me the most is the woman who said, after she was raped, her husband stayed with her, but she said, it's the silence between us, that kills me more than the rape. Sometimes they commit suicide. Sometimes they have a very supportive system around them. They don't. But it's the silence that they go in and they think that they did something wrong. Raped women rarely get killed, actually. They usually are mutilated, but they're more often left alone. And it's like a sign. I call rape as a message from men to men. you know, we march through your land, we rape your women, we pillage your homes, and it's a message from man to man. They really get killed.
But then it can have other consequences, more lasting ones. Women are infected with HIV/AIDS, sometimes are left with painful internal injuries that can cause them to be incontinent, and many of them, as we said earlier, become outcasts in their own societies.
Absolutely. One of the programs that we actually have at Women Former International is talking with men in leadership positions and training them why they have to pay attention to women. And I was recently in Congo, and I talked with the six men that we were training in that one particular community. It was a chief, the pastor, and one of them was the military head of that region. And his quote, he was telling me that, he said, women always got raped. They got raped in peace, they got raped more in war. And I never questioned twice whether I rape a woman or not. I had a gun, I invaded someone's home, I raped his wife. And he said, after he went through the training, and the training, we're trying to tell them why this is not good for them. And he said, I realized I was destroying myself, I was destroying her, I was destroying her, my family, her family, everyone. And his logic was two things. One is HIV, and that's a prominent one. And he's like, I could be infecting her, or she could be infecting me, and two families is destroyed overnight. And his other logic is how he was treating his wife in like an object and not including her as a partner, and how he would win if he treats her better.
Well, this does have an impact on the society as a whole. It undermines the fabric of a society. It never can recover.
That's precisely the goals of rape in wars. In my opinion, it is a message from men to men. It is the expectations that the men will abandon, the families will abandon the raped woman out of shame. It is the messages that the rapist always talk to the raped victim. He says, you will have your enemy as your baby. And that message is constantly said during the act of rape. But it's definitely about the destruction of the social fabric of that society.
And impregnation is one of the goals, you're saying?
Absolutely. It is the, you know, that when it happened in Bosnia, the Serbian soldiers who committed it in an organized manner would always tell the Bosnian woman, we'll have a Chetnik baby. The same thing with the Hutu soldiers or Interahamwe who raped mostly Tutsi women, you'll have a Hutu baby. It's the constantly that your baby is your enemy. And that's how we are infiltrating your family, your society, your community with your enemy.
Well, when you were in high school, you heard that members of the Iraqi secret police videotaped their victims being raped so that they could blackmail them later.
Absolutely. Iraq, during Saddam's time, we had vertical violence against women. It was state-sponsored violence.
Well, his son, Uday, was one of the worst perpetrators.
Absolutely. When his son walked into a university or into any place, in a club, anything, all the women would be scattered around afraid, because if he liked you, you could be going to dinner with your husband and Uday or any of Saddam's members, family members would like you, and you are to be raped that night. There is no resistance. So yes, the Secret Service tortured women, raped them. One of the aunt of the very famous Muqtada Sadr's clerk in Iraq was raped, and they videotaped her rape, and they did not release until she was late stages of her pregnancy.
But sometimes rape is also used in some societies to force a woman to marry the rapist.
That is, yes, it happens in the societies. It's not necessarily happening in the countries that we are working in, because it's mostly wars. But yes, it does happen in other countries.
So what countries are you working in?
We started the work in Croatia and Bosnia. And since then, we've expanded it to Kosovo, to Rwanda, to Congo, Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq, Colombia, among other countries.
And you note in your book that war has changed during the last century. 90% of war casualties were male soldiers 100 years ago. Today, 90% of the casualties are civilians, 75% of them women and children. And women and children also account for 80% of all the refugees.
Yes.
So in a war which we usually think of as a conflict between men, women wind up being the victims, not only the ones who are killed, but the ones who are displaced.
Absolutely. Well, that's the argument of the other side of the war. I argue that we look at war in this country only from a frontline discussion. We look at it from the troops, the tanks, the weapons, the borders, the fighting. All of it is accurate, but it's only one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is what I call the backline discussion, and that has everything to do with water and food and education and love and hate and survival and just fear and all of it and resilience, and that is what women have to face from war. And we've got to understand the backline discussion of war, both in order to have a complex understanding of war is, but also to have an understanding of how to build peace.
Do you think the men who are raping these women understand that it could be reversed, and at a certain point, their wives, their daughters could be raped?
I'm not sure if the men understand that, but it is. I see it as a reversing. You are not only hurting the person who is being raped, you are hurting yourself. And a lot of times domestic violence increases significantly after the war from both sides, the winning side, the raping side, and the losing side. But that has consequences on how violence against women is usually sanctioned in war. It is not necessarily seen as an outrageous thing that should be prohibited. And frankly, a lot of people do this. This is not about Congolese troops or Rwandese troops. This is about the UN troops who also commit rape in peacekeeping situations.
My guest is Zainab Salbi, Zainab Salbi. Her book, The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope, is published by National Geographic. We will continue after this.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We're back with Zainab Salbi, Zainab Salbi. Her book, The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope, is published by National Geographic. It has lots of pictures in them. In this book, some of them very, very shocking, very sad. But the book also talks about some of the things you were able to do. How have you structured your organization?
Well, Women for Women International aims at helping women move from victims to survivors to active citizens. And to do so, we appeal to all women in America and around the world to sponsor one woman at a time by sending her $27 a month, along with a letter to start communication link between the two women.
So you structured this like Save the Children.
Save the Children, except this money is actually going to the adult. We're dealing with adults. It doesn't go to a pool of money. It goes to one woman. You actually do get her picture. You do write to her, and she writes to you, and it's a one-year program. In that 1 year, the sponsored sister goes through an intensive training program in women's rights and in vocational skills and business skills. And at the end of the year, she graduates, and that's when she goes into the active citizen stage, where she gets a job, she's active in her community, she's buying a land, she's creating an income for herself and her family. War in many ways, I learned, is like a flashlight on humanity. It shows you the worst of humanity, but it also shows you the best of humanity. And for someone who has been raped or whose life has been destroyed and feels very alone and feels that humanity has forgotten about me, that letter that you get from that one American woman who says, I care about you, I am here for you, is that flashlight on humanity, on the goodness of it.
I assume that not all women are as receptive to your help as others. There must be some who are just too traumatized and say, leave me alone. I just want to come sit alone and lick my wounds.
Oh, that's so true. There is one, actually, I remember particularly one woman who said, you know, I am too helpless to be helped. Go help someone who can be helped. But these are the exact women that we're like, no, you are the ones. So before we go to any community, whether it's a refugee camp or whether it's an internally displaced community or a localized community, we actually do a community assessment. We try to outreach to these women, go to their homes, visit them, and teach them about what is this program about. One of the things that we do the most in the program is reestablish the support network that is usually destroyed in war. You lose trust in war of your neighbors, of your friends. You no longer have that friend that you can call on a down day and say, I need help. And what war does is this destroys it. And so what we do is group them, 20 women at a time, and they help each other. They become the support network. And that's how we do actually our women's rights training through a year. We meet every other week for a whole year, and we talk about women's role in economy, society, politics, health, all through storytellings and all through ways in which we're sharing knowledge and not imposing knowledge.
And don't you also provide microloans to women so they can start their own businesses?
Exactly. So the money, the $27, helps them meet short-term economic needs. It helps them eat and send their kids to school. The 1 year of training helps them get the skills so they can start a business at the end. They graduate, and that's when we start. That's when the goal is to help them get as many jobs as possible. And so sometimes we do microcredit lending, as in Afghanistan and in Bosnia. Sometimes we do cooperative stores, social enterprises, whatever. To give you an example of the, we did a survey of our Congolese women in our program, about 6,000 of them. We did a survey of 92% of them reported that their income after they graduated was $120 a month. That is compared to their income before they entered the program, which was 20 cents a day. And so the goal is to stand on their feet. And we see that as a political goal, because when they are earning income, they're also voting, they're participating in the politics of the country, and they're having more negotiating powers within the household.
Didn't you study with Mohamed Yunus, who recently won the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, in fact, for his work pioneering microloans?
Yes, I actually...
So he mentored you in this?
Yes, I see Mohamed as a teacher of mine, actually. I spent months in Bangladesh with him in studying their model and comparing it to other models. And both our Bosnia microcredit program and Afghanistan is tailored after the Grameen Bank.
And you've come up with $23 million to lend out?
We actually have altogether distributed $28 million in loans and in aids. It's different countries, $5 million in Bosnia, $3 million. Different countries, different things, but it altogether combines 28.
Now, a caller wonders, and you hear this a lot when you talk about rape, can women be empowered to resist rape, either as a group or individually? This caller asks, why can't these women stand up and stop what's happening?
They are. They absolutely are. They are the circumstances which they are, and there are circumstances which they can't.
If somebody's holding a gun to your head, or there are 8 or 9 men, there's nothing you can do.
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the women that had a huge impact on me is Nabitu, for example. And Nabitu lived in her village. She has 8 children. She was, you know, she had her cows and her sheep and her pigs and all of these things.
She's a Congolese woman.
A Congolese woman, and the rebels attacked. And she said she hid under the table and under the bed and just prayed to God that they will not see them. But the rebels come on masses, and they usually, not only the women cannot resist that act, the men cannot resist.
Because her sons were forced to help?
In the case of Nabitu, they raped her 9-year-old daughter, her 20-year-old daughter, her 23-year-old daughter. They forced her sons to spread her legs and her hands. They asked her sons to rape her. When they refused, they shot them. Usually the rape happens in public space. They separate the men from the women. These are patterns. They rape everyone in the middle of the day in front of the whole community. The men are not resisting either. There is a huge level of violence. Where the resistance is happening, and that is an amazing part, is in the talking. So not Nabitu, but Nabitu herself. But there are other women as well. There is one woman called Henaretta who was a sexual slave for 1.5 years. And in a celebration that we had in Women's Day last March, we asked the governor of Bukavu and the mayors and blah, blah, blah to come and attend the ceremonies. And this woman, who was a sexual slave for 1.5 years, spoke in front of them and said, violence and pain, suffering has an ear, has an eye, and today it has a mouth and it's speaking to you. And this woman is resisting by telling them, you've got to know this is happening to other women.
So that's part of what you try to get the women to do, to actually tell everyone what happened, to bring it out in the open.
That and to stop it. So what they're stopping is the domestic violence and then the rape that is happening after the war. So we have, for example, one community in Bosnia where domestic violence, as I said, increases dramatically after the war. And this community of women there, when they realize one of their members was beaten up severely, they marched to her house, they surrounded the house, they screamed at the husband, they forced him to stop, they called the police, and they said, don't you ever do that again, because it's not about her only, it's about all the women in that community. And domestic violence in that particular village stopped. And there are many incidents and many examples like that is happening around the countries that we are working in.
When you provide these funds for women to start businesses, aren't you doing something that they could not get any other way. In many cultures, these women could not get money to start a business. Banks won't even talk to them.
Many cultures, they aren't the banks, actually, also. And the ones that we are working in will destroy all the infrastructure of a society. But yes, we are talking about people who had something. This is, even if they were the poorest of the poor, they had a shelter at least, and war came and destroyed it and to turn them back to zero. And what I always say, refugees are the best entrepreneurs in the world because they are people who had something and they are eager to return it. And how we do humanitarian aid versus development is a critical point. Humanitarian aid is very important, but there is a line for it where you don't want to pacify the eagerness and the excitement of the person who wants to rebuild their lives. And that's exactly what Women for Women International does. It gives them the break, but it says, we're going to help you stand on your feet as soon as possible to rebuild.
You've expressed concerns about what's happening to women in your homeland. Has the situation gotten worse?
Yes, absolutely. I consider women as bellwether to the society. I think of women as like the kitchen door to the house. Violence often starts with women. When it enters through the kitchen door, no one pays attention to it.
That's what happened to Rwanda.
The classic case of that is Taliban. They entered Afghanistan with violence against women. And everyone looked the other direction. They said it's culture, it's religion, it's all of these things. Well, eventually every single man, child, and woman in Afghanistan impacted. In here, in this city, were impacted. World politics were impacted. The whole world was impacted by that violence. If I am to look at the indicators, and I think also progress starts with women. Women are really the indicator for the directions of the society. And when we look at these thinking and what's happening to Iraqi women, I would say, if I am to codify it, I would say code orange or code red, actually. I know personally of more than 20 professional women, pharmacists, doctors, reporters, professors who have been assassinated for being outspoken and working and keeping their Western lifestyle that we all used to have. Women who are leaving the house without headscarf, they are being targeted for assassination. Those who are driving, they are being targeted for assassination. It is very dangerous to what's happening to Iraqi women at the moment, and we have to pay attention to it.
Isn't male rape also something that occurs in wartime?
It does occur.
Have you come across it?
Oh my gosh, yes, absolutely. I think just as we corner women as being victims in war, we all, and that is an unfair categorization because they're also survival and resilient and incredibly courageous women. I also believe that we corner men as only being aggressors. And when you go and work and you realize that they are victims and they are aggressors and they are the good and the bad and the ugly in all societies. So yes, it does happen to men. But I think there isn't enough attention, research, or even dialogue with men. That's one of the things that Women for Women International does, is actually training men about what does it mean to be in good leadership? What does it mean to listen to what the women have to say about how to run a society?
And I understand that congratulations are in order because Women for Women has been selected by the Conrad and Hilton Foundation to receive its annual $1.5 million prize for humanitarian work. This is the first women's organization to ever receive this honor?
And it's the youngest woman, it's the youngest organization to have received this honor. It is an incredible honor. You know, the staff I have overseas, they are heroines. They are really, they're walking 2 hours to go to a small committee to mobilize the women. In Iraq, I just talked to a staff who says sometimes the mud is up to her knees and she walks just to mobilize the women and give them economic opportunities. And they do that because we believe that strong women lead to strong nations. And to get this acknowledgement from the Conrad Hilton Humanitarian Prize Award, it's sort of the realization that someone is paying attention, that strong, it's important to invest in women, that strong women do indeed lead to strong nations, and that we can make a difference one woman at a time.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I've been speaking with Zainab Salbi. This is your second book, right?
It's my second book, yes.
First one, a memoir, and this one, a story that contains women's stories of survival and hope, The Other Side of War. It is published by National Geographic. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and I hope everyone join us as being a sponsor, one woman at a time.
And I'll tell people more about that in just a moment. Zainab Salbi will be speaking at the Women of the World Awards Gala tomorrow night. That's Thursday, November 30th at 6:30 p.m. at Chelsea Piers. For more information about that, you can visit our website at wnyc.org. And at that website, you can also find a link for Women for Women's website, or you can just go directly to it, womenforwomen.org. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.